You're listening to a Bookmark podcast. For rights reasons, we've had to shorten or omit some of the music chosen by our guests, but we hope you still enjoy listening.
You're listening to Bookmark on Cambridge 105.
Hello and welcome to Bookmark on Cambridge 105 with me, Lee Chambers. This is the show that talks about books and writing with a local slant. And my studio guest today is Nicola Streeton, here to talk about her graphic novel, Billy, Me and You. And we'll also be hearing from historians Midge Gillies to talk about army wives from Crimea to Afghanistan, and Caroline Shenton on her book about the rebuilding of the Houses of Parliament. But nice to have you with us, Nicola Streeton.
Thank you. Nice to be here.
I was saying to you outside, just before we came into the studio, and you said you must share this story. You're my second Nicola of the day. It's still very early. This is a pre-recorded show, still very early. And on the way here, knowing that you would be walking to the station, I saw a lady who looked like you, who I stopped and said, she was walking behind me, and as she overtook me, I thought, that's Nicola, that's my author. I said, hello, you call Nicola? Yes, she said. And I said, oh, it's Lee. Right, she said. And I said, I'm going to the studio. Right, she said. I said, are you Nicola Streeton? No, she said. So that's quite a coincidence, isn't it?
Yeah, I suppose I was just thinking, it's like when you phone someone and you say, hello, it's me, and they carry on a conversation thinking it's a different me.
You know, that's you can find out all sorts that way. Yeah. We are going to give you a proper introduction in just a moment, but our other two guests today are non-fiction writers. And I introduced you as a graphic novelist there. Mm-hmm. How would you describe your book, Billy, Me and You? Because is it a novel? Is it a memoir? You know, what is the fiction, non-fiction mix in that?
Well, it's become classified as a graphic memoir. So my approach is that it's not fiction, but in a sense, in my head, I think it is, in the same way that I've tweaked the truth to make it a narrative that is accessible is the word, to the reader. So in that sense, I think it's from my point of view. So in the way that history is also from a particular angle. So it's, you can say it's the truth, but it's only one truth.
Yes. But the graphic novel, in a way, is quite suited to that form, it seems to me.
Yes. It is, because you can play with ideas of time and truth. And so you can have two meanings in one panel, for example, or the image can contradict or say a different story to the text that's there.
The eye sort of moves quicker over the images than it would over prose.
Yes, I think so. And yet take it in. I think you take it in, although it looks like an easy style or you're doing it quickly. I think the brain is assimilating the information from both sources, from the visual and the text.
Well, we're going to talk, of course, a lot about Billy, Me and You. Very moving. A memoir of grief and recovery. Very moving book indeed. But we're going to hear your first choice of music now, which is, it's unusual, if you don't mind me saying this. Not what I expected. It's Motorhead and Ace of Spades. Why this one?
Well, actually, the thing is, you asked me to choose music. I'm not a great music person until this summer, but this one, we do car journeys as a family, myself, my husband and our daughter, and we each have very different tastes in music. So this is my husband, John Plam. So we all kind of compete to play our music. And so our daughter made a playlist for us for this long journey with all of us. So this is the one where I actually, if I'm in control, turn it down. And my husband, John Plam, says, no, this is mine. Turn it up. I said, no, I don't really like it. None of us like each other's taste. So this is, you'll see.
This is for John, then,
yeah,
really.
This is for John.
Dedication. You're nowhere near the volume controls this time, I'm afraid. Here. Well, that certainly blew the cobwebs away. That's the Ace of Spades by Motorhead, the first choice of music of our studio guest on Bookmark today, Nicola Streeton. Nicola's son, Billy, was 2 years old when he died following heart surgery for problems diagnosed only 10 days earlier. 13 years later, she revisited a diary written at the time of Billy's death and began translating the notes and entries into the graphic novel Billy, Me and You, a memoir of grief and recovery, published in 2011. Nicola, we're going to be talking a lot about the novel and the format, but let's first talk about Billy. Tell me a little bit about Billy.
He was born in 93, so it's some time ago. And he was our first child and of myself and John. And he was a delight. He was, you know, everything we'd wanted. And what amazed me in his life was because I grew up I was one of four children, and our dad always used to say, oh, girls are different to boys. And my sister and I both studied social sciences. We went, no, it's all culture. And he went, no. And then we had this little son who was obsessed with trains, absolutely, and transport and, you know, anything, Ninas, all that sort of thing. So that we had a great fun, sort of, and I was introduced to the sort of joys of standing at train stations.
The world of Thomas the Tank Engine,
exactly,
yeah.
All that. We had a really lovely time with him for 2 years. And then when he was one, he had pneumonia, which is, again, when it's whatever number child it is, you never know, really. There's this sort of idea that the mother always knows if there's something wrong with their child, but I had I didn't think there was anything wrong, because when he had pneumonia, everyone around me in my circle said, oh yes, you know, I got to find people whose other children had pneumonia, so it's normal anyway. Then the patch on his lung didn't go away, which was not normal, so they started a series of tests at the hospital, and he was thin, but he was well, so just had coughs and colds, which is normal for children. And then the tests kept coming back negative, and then finally we were at the Brompton looking into lungs, and they tested his heart and found three abnormalities which had caused his breathing problems by this time, which was like asthma. So when he was born, it hadn't been picked up because these abnormalities had worked to keep him alive. So it was this quite odd in a way, that the body is an extraordinary thing. So then they immediately decided to operate to fix the abnormalities. And the operation was very long and it was successful, but he died afterwards in intensive care, which is the dangerous bit, really, of a major operation. And that was it was very shocking, because we'd only had the diagnosis 10 days before, and we were so relieved to have something after this year of sort of various tests that and then that, you know, when you go into a hospital, there's that reassurance, or you go there to get fixed if you're well. I have that idea still. It's perhaps quite naive, but you know, there's only so much. There's no guarantee of life or really.
Well,
so
you start the novel, the memoir, at that point where you're leaving the hospital carrying his belongings.
Yeah.
Which is devastating.
Yeah, it was all devastating. And then so we leave the hospital, and they have had then these carrier, sort of grey carrier, NHS carrier bags. So it's this sort of, it was awful. I mean, it was very vivid in my mind still, visual. And then we got into our car, which we'd always said was Billy's car because of his love of transport, and it wouldn't start. So there was all this sort of magical things going on. And then I was running after ambulance things, saying, have you got a jump lead? Have you got a jump lead? So there's sort of pathos and comedy at the same time in this devastation. And our family standing around, who'd come straight away to the hospital, just also in this hideous state of shock and bereavement and not knowing what to do, not to make us feel better. So this whole it's very, very vivid in my mind today, but also somewhat protected in that initial moment, protected in some way, because you're in the shock protects you from the reality, which trickles in over years, really. I think it that sort of thing never goes away. So I think that's the other, what I was wanting to address in the book was our how grief works, really, and how people around us respond to our grief and how we respond to their response. So that's what I wanted. What I found the book became was a dialogue with the reader in attitudes to death, really.
Yes, you talk about that, the limits to the display of grief that you're allowed, almost, and the expression, that face as well, that people put on.
Yeah, which I too do, by the way. You know, that was one of the things I found myself doing later on, you know, as the years went by and now still.
And it's okay for you to talk about this now. I mean, it's a long time ago, and you've said publicly, you know, it's not upsetting anymore.
Yeah, it's really odd. I don't know this. I say that with such confidence, but then I certainly this summer I've really been reflecting of maybe it is coming out as I get older. You know, you revisit. I don't think it goes away, but what happened with the book, which is when we started, you asked me what form is it, and I said it is fact or non-fiction, and it is a truth, but because I moved the time frames around in the story, and I moved the events, they weren't linear, you know, I didn't present them in that way, so I created something else. And I've talked to other graphic memoirists who Matilda Tristram did a graphic memoir fairly recently, and I heard her talk to her about this. She says it becomes something else than the experience when you put it into a book. So it's like it becomes an art form, really. So it's your distance from it. So certainly when I was making it, I really enjoyed the process. I didn't cry at all. So but I don't know whether I say so confidently, no, it wasn't cathartic. No, I'm fine. But I don't really know if I am or not. One never knows.
Well, I suppose it's through two filters, really, isn't it? Because you're going back to, this was a diary that you've written at the time, which you're then transcribing in a different form.
And that, yes, yeah, which was really a nice process to do that as well, research-wise, I guess.
And this was a contemporaneous diary of thoughts that you had written down during this whole process.
It was a complete... the diary was basically a word vomit after Billy died. It was everything. So in just everything in my head that I slapped on the page, but in written form, because I wasn't drawing, I wasn't a drawer at that time, so I didn't have that language. But after Billy's death, I started drawing. I mean, I'd had a bit of training at art school, but I didn't see myself as going further with that by the time Billy was born. But I returned to the visual, and then I became. So I started after he died. I started drawing these little cartoony. Drawings to cheer myself up, really, funny little things about parenting, which sounds odd, but through that process I developed a portfolio to become an illustrator, so which is what I did. So 13 years later I had a different language to the written language, which is why I came back to the story and put it in that form.
Well, yes, why did you go back to that story? What made you suddenly sit down and think, I want to put this into pictures?
Well, it was a pause in my... It was a stage in my... As a freelance illustrator, so I'd been working as a freelancer for about 12 years or so, and had come to an impasse, and I wanted something to rejuvenate me professionally, my professional development. So I signed up to do an MA, and the graphic novel form had become had been introduced to me. So in the late 2000s, 2006-07, there was Chris Ware, an American graphic novelist, had won the Guardian First Book Award for his work, and works like that were autobiographical, and they weren't superheroes or Beano's. They were something more sophisticated. And so that put me, I thought, oh, I've got the language I developed in my illustration was comic, was cartoon style with text, so image and word, in little one panel gags. So I thought, oh, this could be a language I could do something with in a longer form. And I was thinking of, so I signed up to an MA thinking I would do an adaptation of a prose work. And then I suddenly thought, why? Hang on, this is, I've got the story. I've got a story that I know is big, you know, in terms of subject matter. So I decided then to do it. And then at that point, I thought, oh, I'm ready to open that box of diaries, because I hadn't returned to it in those 13 years because I couldn't open the wound. It would be like scratching the wound open again. But it was fine because it was for a purpose of a creative project. And when we collected this box, so we had this box of all the paraphernalia when Billy died, that John and I, both of us had it. And we knew straight away that that was what we needed to do, and that later we would revisit it when we were emotionally ready, because we, so that something would come out of this, some sort of project. But at the time, we thought it would be immediate. So we started collaboratively writing about it, but it wasn't our, either of our language. So that's how it came.
Because your husband is an artist as well. Yeah. So yes, presumably that was an easy, not an obvious thing to turn to, but more obvious than for some people.
It was our salvation at the time, really, when after Billy died, we both plunged ourselves into our artworks, which very different practices, but very therapeutic in that sense. So we were quite separately as well in our studio practice, and then, you know, would come together. But the works that, certainly the works John did at the time really were shocking to me, because I read them as very autobiographical of, you know, I was saying, oh, that piece you've made, which is a great big installation in a gallery, was, that's the operation, isn't it? So I was reading the, you know, he's working with lines and so on. So it was really interesting what happened to how we made ourselves feel better in that immediate aftermath.
Well, we're going to come back to that, because how much you chose to share of Billy. There's a lot, obviously, quite a lot of him in the book, pictures in the book, and why you did that. But we will come back in just a moment. We're going to take a slight diversion now and listen to Midge Gillies. Midge is the author of 7 non-fiction books, including biographies of Amy Johnson and Mary Lloyd. In the barbed wire university, she explored what it was really like to be an Allied prisoner of war. Researching that book inspired her next, Army Wives, From Crimea to Afghanistan, The Real Lives of Women Behind the Men in Uniform, published in August. She told Alex Elbro what else gave her the impetus to find out more about army wives.
I've been watching the Gareth Malone TV programme about military wives, and I was completely hooked on it, and I find it very moving. But also I thought these women have lots in common with Victorian wives, for example, particularly the song that became the Christmas number one. The lyrics were drawn from letters and poems they wrote to their husbands. The sentiments they were expressing of loss and worry were sentiments that any wife in the past would have felt. So that was one reason. I felt I had unfinished business with prisoners of war because I hadn't had space in the book to write about the wives and the girlfriends who were left behind. And they were incredibly important because they were sending letters to their menfolk, often not knowing whether they're alive or dead, whether letters were getting through, and then really picking up the pieces at the end of the war if the husband or boyfriend did make it home. So they were the people who coped with the mental and physical fallout of captivity, and often really horrendous instances of malnutrition and mental abuse as well. And then finally, just looking at my parents' wedding photo, my dad in his uniform still, hadn't quite been demobbed. This is 1946. And then each of their parents and both of my grandparents served in the First World War. So I thought, well, you know, I don't come from an army background yet. So I can see just from this photo, there are 3 army wives in this. And I felt that that would apply to so many other people in this country. So I wanted to look at those experiences.
These army wives had a lot to deal with, not just while they're away and the pain of that and sorting out the family and everything else, but they had to kind of pick up the pieces with probably very little help.
After the Second World War, there was still very little known about mental health. And my dad, I remember my mum saying he used to wake up just soaking with sweat. He'd had nightmares, but he never spoke about it, and it was something that he felt he just got on with, really.
So where did you find your research for this? As I imagine, you know, conventional archives that didn't necessarily have this sort of thing stored.
I went all over the country, so there were some very interesting archives in Cambridge, in the South Asia Centre there. Letters, particularly from women who were in India during what was known as the Indian Mutiny. So talking about sieges they'd been involved in, really appalling conditions. Going back up even further, I read some letters from a woman who was from southwest Scotland. So this is the beginning of the Victorian period. And she was writing back to her mother and talking about, you know, how it's very difficult with a long dress to wander through briars. And, you know, it's very hot in this kind of weather. But she died very suddenly because people were just taken away overnight in India because of the illnesses that they didn't fully understand and couldn't do anything about. So that was one place I went for. Obviously, the Imperial War Museum, there's some quite interesting letters. I went up to Leeds University as well. But I did find it difficult to find the woman's voice because those letters were so treasured that often they just wouldn't survive the heat of battle, or they'd be read so often that they disintegrated. And also that the wife of someone from the lower classes, because, you know, they didn't have the time or the education to write. I mean, that changes in the 20th century, but you don't get those voices coming through in the Victorian period.
You've got an interesting story about some of the letters that you found.
Yeah, so I was getting a bit troubled by the fact that I didn't have as many sources from wives as I would have liked. And I opened a newspaper one day and there was an item about an auction of Second World War letters that were up for sale. And they sounded very interesting. They were by a woman called Diana Carnegie. The news item focused on was the end of the war, so the celebrations in Trafalgar Square, and how Diana, in very explicit language, was talking about couples making love and really enjoying themselves. And I thought, this woman sounds really interesting. I'll see what else is in this archive. I got them. Eventually, this huge box of letters arrived, and they were fantastic, really interesting, rich material. And then eventually the auction house phoned and said, well, unfortunately, we've got some good news and some bad news. And I said, so what's the bad news? And they said, all the letters are stolen. But the good news was that the family were delighted that I wanted to write about their parents and happy for me to quote anything from the letters, and hadn't even known that the letters existed. It had a happy ending in the end. Yeah.
Going back to that then, how long has it taken you to research this book?
Probably taken me about 4 years from getting the commission to it being published. Well, me delivering the manuscript, actually. I do other things. So I teach at the Institute of Continuing Education based at Madingley Hall. So I teach creative writing there. Writing nonfiction is a lot of research. You have to jettison a lot of what you write as well. So it's a long, hard haul.
I imagine it's going through lots and lots to find the little gems every
now and then. And also work out what the story is. So that changes the whole time as you shape the material that you get.
How did you choose to structure the book? Because it must have been quite hard to work out whether you were going to do women of a certain type through the wars. And so how did that come about?
So a lot of structuring is about just experimenting. So you have chapter plans or idea, that's how I work, and you have an outline, but it changes. So once you start writing, you can see that actually that doesn't really logically make sense, or this person is making a case to be in your story more than you might have expected. And the beginning always gets rewritten, because the beginning is just getting you started. And then when you finish the whole thing, you can see how your kind of argument has changed. And you can see that the beginning, you know, isn't as good as it should be. You edit and edit the whole time, really. And luckily, it's much easier to move things around. And my plan was to have a broadly chronological approach, but within that have themes. So when I was talking about accommodation in the 19th century, I was talking about how when army wives were on the go, they had a lot of, especially the well-to-do ones, they had campaign furniture, which was furniture that they could take with them on campaigns. And then I was talking about how what it's like to be an army wife today, and how you might move maybe quite easily 19 times in a short career, and you get to know 19 different ovens, and you'd be marched in and out and have your army quarters inspected. So I wanted to kind of give an overview of the whole period as well when I was doing it.
The women often came with them to the front line, which is something I hadn't even realised.
The Crimea was the last time that was allowed. And with the ordinary soldiers' wives, it would be a ballot whether they were allowed to go. And again, that was kind of really heartrending stuff, because it was at the dockside often. So it was, you knew at the very last minute whether your wife is going to be able to come with you. And the ordinary wives, they would supplement their income by sewing and cooking and nursing. but have very basic accommodation. So they might live in a kind of hole in the ground or in a cave in Crimea. So very tough conditions. They didn't have time to write. Most of them weren't educated. Whereas the officers' wives would stay in hotels or quite kind of fancy tents or huts that were built for them or on board some of the ships, and they would write back. So there was one in particular, Fanny Dubley, who wrote back and wrote, did journalism as well. So she became quite a character at the front and would take, took her horses with her. Roger Fenton, who was a famous photographer in the Crimea, sold photos of her because she was very beautiful and she was quite flirtatious as well. And there were the rumours that she was having various affairs, but I really don't think she was.
And did you notice from that a change in the style of writing as you move through time?
Well, it does vary a lot. So, for example, in the First World War, I was surprised at how much actually of a man's feelings he might incorporate in a letter. On the other hand, he would also know that his letter would be passed around and read by lots of people. So members of the family, the wider family, all through history, wives and the husbands have come up with codes to get information across. You know, they obviously make reference to something that only the husband and wife would understand. So they'll say, if you remember that cafe we went to in Scarborough, that'll give you a clue as to where we are in France. And it probably had some kind of fancy French name, and that would mean something to them. My husband's parents in the Second World War, he would always say something like, if he was going to come home on leave soon, I've just shaved my moustache off, which meant, you know, I'll be back soon. Lots of that will be lost because obviously we don't know those kind of hidden codes, but I think it's fascinating that people did that. And now things have changed quite dramatically because we've got 24-hour news and people are texting and Skyping and using Facebook, and you'd think on one hand that that would be more helpful, but there have been studies that have shown that it means that the soldier, say in Afghanistan, has got his head in two places really, and that's not very helpful if you're concentrating on keeping safe. And often there's too much information. So a wife might say, I'm really struggling with homework for Tom. You know, I can't do the maths. The fridge is broken and your mother is driving me nuts. What can the husband do about that? You know, it's funny how actually the letter is still important. Mm-hmm. And soldiers' wives will, even if they're emailing, there's something they can do where they send an email and it comes out the other end as a letter. So I think that the letter is still really, really important, and the chance to hold that letter, something tangible, a link with home.
How did you feel about reading private letters and diaries? Yeah.
Well, it feels like a real privilege to read those letters and diaries. It honestly feels a bit voyeuristic. If you don't do that and you don't use them, then they're lost. Those stories are lost. And there are so few stories and accounts of women anyway that I think anything that reminds us and future generations of what women went through, it has to be a good thing, really, be able to do that, you know. And I've sat in so many archives weeping silently, so it is like being able to touch a ghost, and it's very immersive and very odd experience, really.
And how do you feel your writing has changed since you've written your first book?
I started off as a journalist, so I'd like to think that I'm writing more in a creative way, and that's kind of tied in with my teaching, because I do believe that anyone who writes non-fiction can use all the tools that a writer of fiction has at their disposal. So you should be able to write very good descriptions. You should be able to bring a person to life. You can include dialogue. I think non-fiction can be as exciting, as funny as fiction too. So that's what I'm aiming at. And I think I have progressed a long way along that road, but I've still got a long way to go as well.
That's Midge Gillies there talking to Alex Elbrow about her book Army Wives, which is published by Aurum Press. Incidentally, there's a longer interview with Midge Gillies. If you go to the Cambridge 105 website, which is cambridge105.fm, and go down the bookmark podcast, we had Midge Gillies in as a studio guest about a year and a half ago. But our studio guest today on Bookmark is Nicola Streeton. Nicola, Midge talking there about what a privilege it was to read those private letters and memories and to share them. Of course, you were sharing in your book, Billy, Me and You, were sharing very private feelings. Did you have a mental line at which you thought, I'm not going to go beyond that, or was it give and take? You know, how much did you share about how you were feeling, about how John had felt and about Billy?
I think I shared everything.
No line then.
Yeah, that, which is, John was very much part of the story. So I never showed him any of it, but I knew that he'd be okay with it. So I'm not sure if it would be the same if, you know, I don't think it's always the same. I think there is a line with different situations of trauma and or when you're writing about your family. And I also wonder, so our next child, Sally, who is now 19, she was born after Billy died. But I wonder if I would have, if that line would have changed if she had been alive already.
What does Sally think of the book?
Well, she read it. She waited a while to read it after it had come out. And she was really good about it because she wanted to engage with the form before she made a judgment on it. So she read through my collection of graphic novels that I'd by then accumulated so that she could. And then she read my book and then she gave me critical feedback of or she was able to align it with what's out there. So I think she thought it was good and was quite, I think, well, there's two things. First, I think it was nice for her to watch us as a family, to watch me producing something. It's quite interesting from your real life how you can produce an artwork. So I think that was I haven't discussed it with her, but I think that might have been interesting. And then also that she had grown up knowing about that she was a beloved child that came after this tragedy. So she knew that we had, both John and I, had experienced this depression and so on. So we were never hid that from her. And then also when I was actually working on it, she was 11 or 12, and how it actually first was made public was in a little zine that we made together. And so because she was slightly embarrassed that I was doing this depressing, boring stuff about death, so she was saying, why don't we make a fun comic and have some funny little things about a children's page and puzzles and so on, because she was becoming into teenager we were both feeling there's nothing out there. So we did about 8 issues of this zine called Licorice, and it's from that So I was put it together and did the printing, and then it was from that I sent it round, and it was from that Myriad Editions, who published the book, first saw what I was doing. I'd slip in this little chapter of depressing, boring death stuff at the end of the production, and then Corinne Perlman, I gave her a copy, and she had it on her pile of stuff that people give her for some months, and then when she saw it, she kind of said, oh, you know, let's talk. This is really interesting. It's a really interesting subject matter, and we'd be interested in publishing it when it's finished as a long.
And I wonder if for Sally, Billy is very much in there, you know, and the brother that she never met.
Yeah.
There's pictures of him. I mean, it is his real name.
Yes, yes.
You do get a sense. You talk about his love of trains and how he was particular at the end. I wonder if it was a way for her to sort of meet him in a funny way.
Oh, yes, yes. Well, I must ask her all these questions. yes, I think you're right. An awareness and the photos and that's, yes, the camera never lies. That's
and you were you chose to obviously to share all that information about him.
Yeah, yeah. So there was, and it was part, it was almost like an archive, like the
history, yeah, Mitch.
Yeah, was talking about, you rummage through. So it was interesting hearing her talk, because it is a very similar process. You select what you, and it was interesting her talking about what story she was going to make from this huge archive in her case. So it's a similar thing, is what story you weave, how you present the truth or what you found.
Well, let's go to your second choice of music now. I don't know if this is another from your car tape. This is Sister Sledge, yes. Lost in Music.
Yeah, this is my summer. You see, this summer I was, you know, let's say a midlife crisis I'm in the throes of. And so I was revisiting my 20s and I suddenly thought, oh, yeah, this is, I do like music. So this is the kind of, you know, memories of dancing as a student in Brighton.
You're listening to Bookmark on Cambridge 105.
Lost in Music by Sister Sledge, a second choice of music today from our studio guest on Bookmark, Nicola Streeton, here to talk about her graphic memoir, Billy, Me and You, about the death of her son Billy and the grieving process following it. I just wanted to talk about, we've talked a lot about the emotion and the motivation behind it, the actual practicality of putting it down, of finding pictures to fit to scenes. How did you go about that? Because the illustrations vary, don't they? Some are very smudged and some are more precise, and you've got some on actually on a diary page as well. It's a lovely variation, but I wondered how you made the choices about each of those pictures, not about every single one.
A lot of it was because, as I mentioned, I'd signed up to do a MA, to do a practical MA at Art of Design at the University of Lincoln. And very quickly, because of the responses I got from fellow students of, oh, that's so depressing, doing it about death, or why don't you do it? Why do you need pictures? And I was so interested in their responses that I decided, and so frustrated with being asked to do character sheets, which isn't the way I work, because I'm really an autodidact I'm self-taught as an illustrator. So I switched to a Master of Research, which is an academic MA, a master's degree there, because I was interested in the questions around death and the taboos and our responses. But what I was reading around was also the form of autobiography. So I was, and the graphic novels. So I was looking at ways, techniques to communicate with the reader through the visual form. So it was things like by using an actual paper of a diary, it's inviting you into this very personal and private space. It gives that immediate symbol. That's what it's a symbol of, and the dates and the photos as well. By seeing the photos is quite shocking, because it suddenly, it's the drawn form is your distance, and then suddenly boom, there you are. Oh, it must be true, because it's that whole thing, the camera never lies. So although it does. So I used photography in that way, and I also drew myself as I am now, looking directly out at you, the reader. So it's like I am sharing this with you. I'm looking into your eyes and telling you my deepest emotional trauma. So it's, again, it's bringing the reader into a very private space. So all those things were kind of some conscious, some not conscious. And the actual drawing responded, I suppose. It's that trace of the artist.
It is very direct. So you do feel you're being spoken to. It's a quite remarkable book. We'll shift gear again. We will come back to you, Nicola. But we're shifting gear again to hear now from Caroline Shenton. She was director of the Parliamentary Archives at Westminster from 2008 to 2014. Her first book, The Day Parliament Burned Down, won the inaugural Political Book of the Year Award in 2013. It was also shortlisted for the Longman History Today Prize and was a Book of the Year for the Daily Telegraph, New State, and Daily Mail. Mr. Barry's War is the sequel, as Caroline explained when we met.
So Mr. Barry's War is the story of the rebuilding of the Houses of Parliament in the 19th century following the Great Fire of 1834 that burnt down the Old Palace. And it covers the story of Charles Barry, the architect, and the sort of struggles that he had in creating the most famous building in Britain.
And why did you write it?
Well, this is really a sequel to my previous book, The Day Parliament Burned Down, which was the story of the great forgotten disaster of 1834. People forget that the current Houses of Parliament is a 19th century building. They think it's a medieval building, but it wasn't. It was created in the wake of this great fire. So it seemed natural to write a sequel.
And what is it about this building that fascinates you? You've written two books about it. Clearly you have a fascination, a connection with it somehow.
Well, that's right. Well, I've worked for the Parliamentary Archives since 1999, and I've worked in this amazing building. And really the stories come out of the woodwork there. First, the story of the Great Fire of 1834, and now the story of the rebuilding, just full of fascinating characters and extraordinary anecdotes about this amazing building.
It is an amazing building. It's very iconic. And you mention in your book how there's a lot of symbolism thrust onto this building, that it represents Britishness, it represents democracy.
That's right. It's really a symbol of the nation and of representative democracy the world over. it's one of the main reasons that people perhaps come to the UK alongside the monarchy. Big Ben is on the back of every possible news story whenever anybody's talking about Parliament. So it's always there.
So for an architect wanting to build it, they're very aware of that. It's a lot of pressure.
A huge amount of pressure. At the time, Charles Barry won the competition in 1836 to create this brand new building. He was already very successful, but he really had no idea the sort of struggle that he was going to face over the next 24 years in creating it.
And what kind of struggles did he face?
Well, there were three kinds of struggle, I guess, three kinds of battle that he was facing in this war. First of all, there was the battle with the elements. There was the battle with the site itself. So the Houses of Parliament, built on the side of the Thames, is actually on a really cramped site. There's the water on one side, and then on the other side, there's Westminster Abbey. So there's not very much space to actually expand if you're wanting to create a bigger building. So he had to deal with that. And then when they raised the site, when they raised the ruins of the old palace, they discovered the site was full of quicksand. So very, very challenging. And he dealt with that by creating a giant concrete platform across the site called the Barry Raft. And he also built half of the palace out into the Thames itself, which was a huge technological and civil engineering feat for the day. Then the sort of second struggle he had was actually the political struggle, getting the money together, getting the approvals, dealing with all the members of Parliament, all of whom had different ideas about what the building should be like. Should they be at Westminster altogether? Should they move away? All the rows that ensued as a result of that. And then finally, the third struggle was the struggle for his reputation. He was criticised a lot during his own lifetime. There was this massive row that broke out after his death between his family and the family of his co-architect and co-designer, Augustus Pugin, about who was really responsible for the building, and had Barry somehow done down Pugin's contribution. And really that assault on his reputation carried right on into the 20th century. And it's only really in the last few decades that art and architectural historians have really come to understand that this building is really a combination of both men's genius.
There's lots in the book about all the decisions that he had to make at every stage. I was particularly interested because we take it for granted now. You know, we see Parliament, that's what it looks like. But all that discussion about whether it was oblong or circular.
Yes, it's not just a building that's landed from outer space. It went through many different changes during the design process. The reason why the Commons Chamber is rectangular is because Barry chose to design the floor space along the same lines as the old Chapel of St Stephen's in the old Palace of Westminster, which had been the home of the old House of Commons. And so we've got these two sets of benches opposite one another in today's House of Commons. And that really is based on extraordinarily on the medieval model of the ancient royal chapel. Barry chose to continue that, but of course he could have gone in a different direction if he'd wanted to. He could have created what's called a hemicycle in continental parliaments.
Like, Holyrood, I suppose.
That's right, a sort of horseshoe shape. People still say today, why isn't Parliament in a horseshoe shape? Wouldn't it be better? Wouldn't it be less confrontational if we had it like that? Well, there's actually very little evidence that a horseshoe shape stops confrontations. I think you only have to look at the massive fights in the Italian parliaments and the Ukrainian parliaments, where you get members clambering over the desks to punch each other to show that a semicircular setup doesn't necessarily stop politics being confrontational.
But is it still fit for purpose? Because this is a building that was built over 100 years ago, almost 200 years ago. Is it still fit for purpose?
Well, the current proposed restoration and renewal of the palace is, in fact, down to one of the legacies of the design process from the 19th century. Lots of experts were foisted on Barry during the course of the rebuilding. One of them was called David Boswell Reed, and he was a ventilation scientist. And he really used Barry's design as a sort of giant experimental site for his theories. And he punched ventilation shafts through the building to practice his theories. And it's in fact those ventilation shafts, those great sort of uprises and things through the palace, that now are causing problems, because over the decades, over 150 years really, they've become clogged with all the services required to keep the building going. The pipework, the water, the gas, the electricity, they were sprayed with asbestos after the Second World War. they've been very badly documented. Nobody exactly knows what's there. And new pipes have been put in over time on top of old pipes, which have become obsolete. And it's those that need stripping out, because otherwise the building is probably going to grind to a halt.
This is a building you know very well. You've written two books about it and you worked there. Is it a building that keeps on giving? You know, the more you find out about it, the more information there is, the more stories there
are. It's a fabulous building. It's like walking through a stage set each day. You never get tired of it and you never take it for granted. And of course, even if Parliament were to move away from that site, this great building, the greatest building in Britain, would still need to be maintained and kept for the nation.
And what's your favourite bit of the building?
Oh, there are so many favourite bits. One of my favourite bits is the Victoria Tower, which is the great square tower at the southern end of the palace. That's the home of the Parliamentary Archives, so you would expect me to say that. But another favourite part of the building is the central lobby, the great octagonal lobby full of wonderful Gothic decoration by Pugin, which is really the crossroads of Parliament, the beating heart of the building, if you like. It's where all the corridors lead to in the centre of the building. It's got an octagon, very similar to the octagon at Ely Cathedral as well. So it does look in some respects very, very familiar to people who might be visiting from Cambridge.
And was the one thing you found out in the research for this book that you didn't know that quite surprised you?
Oh, absolutely loads of things I didn't know. Perhaps the most fascinating thing is that Charles Barry was actually born in Westminster. He was a local boy born in pretty modest circumstances in a house just opposite where the clock tower, today the Elizabeth Tower, which houses Big Ben, is. That struck me as really amazing, that he must have known Westminster like the back of his hand, so that by the time he was 39 and won the competition to build the new building, it was almost fated in advance that he was going to do that.
And are you done now on this subject, or will you write more?
that's a good question. I'm currently working on a proposal for the next book with my agent. We're not quite sure what it's going to be. Is it going to create a trilogy or not? We're not quite sure. So it's a question of watch this space.
And when you go on holiday, I'm just wondering, do you have to go to the Parliament buildings to compare and contrast, you know, if you're in Rome?
Yes, in a rather sad way, actually. I do, if we go to a capital city, if we go on a city break, then I do tend to end up nosing around the parliamentary buildings of those capitals. And I have a blog, and I do blog about other parliamentary buildings on there. My favourite Parliament building is the Parliament of Luxembourg, which is sort of a semi-detached house, which I think is rather amusing. So
very different to the Palace of Westminster.
Rather different from the Palace of Westminster, yes.
That was Caroline Shenton there talking about her book, Mr. Barry's War, which is published by Oxford University Press. Well, Nicola Streeton, we're coming to the end of our time with you on Bookmark. There's ever so many questions that I haven't asked you, but I suppose the most obvious one now is, what are you up to now? What's your next project?
I'm actually completing a PhD that I will finish in a few months on the cultural history of British feminist cartoons and comics. So it's been about spurred by revisiting my teenage visual track. So some of these the music is my soundtrack, and the cartoons I used to buy at Camden Lock as postcards. So it's asking what's happened to those cartoonists like Annie Lawson, Jackie Fleming, and
Annie
that's
Lawson,
what my
yes
do you remember?
Yes, I do. So that's from the past.
Yes, yeah. Exactly. So I'm thinking what's happened to these great women who informed me, my sense of humour, and also my drawing style. So they're included in my research, my documentation, which is there's this gap in comics documentation and cartoons. So that's what I'm doing. And then I'm kind of revisiting this, my 20s in a way, and I'm wondering if something, my next creative project will be based on that as an older woman. You know, the expectations and hopes and aspirations we have in our 20s, and then at the other... In our 50s, looking back.
So that's,
yes. So I'm curious about that. That might inform what I do creatively after the PhD. But
and your husband is an artist.
Yeah.
Would you work collaboratively together?
No, we talk about it, but our practices are very different. So he's, was trained as a sculptor and is interested in conceptual art. So that's his ideas form his practice in that sense. And so although we both do drawing, it's different types of drawing. And mine is more for book or for more popular culture, within popular culture, I guess I would position myself.
Well, it's been lovely talking to you today. I highly recommend Nicola Streeton's book, Billy, Me and You, a memoir of grief and recovery, which is published by Myriad Editions. We're going to come back to you in a moment, Nicola, to talk us through your last choice of music. But in our next bookmark, our studio guest is Sarah Burton. Sarah is the director of the Creative Writing Programme at Cambridge University and author of several non-fiction books, as well as a children's book, The Complete and Utter History of the World, according to Samuel Stewart, age 9. We'll also hear from Naz Assen and Jenny Caswell. They're authors of The Laid-Back Guide to Exams and Stress. And Victoria Innes will be talking to Laura Bates from the Everyday Sexism Project about her new book, Girl Up. But we'll sign out now with your last choice of music, Nicola, which is this track from Toots and the Maytals. 54 to 46 was my number. Is this another one from your misspent youth?
Yes, and this is the one on the family soundtrack that everyone can like. And sorry that Sally didn't get her
sorry,
choice.
Sally.
We couldn't find it. Too modern. But so this is the one we all like. So it's...
Sing it up, mister. Hear what I say, sir. Yeah, yeah. No, 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 no. Yeah. Get your hands in the air, sir.